probably know that on Wednesday evenings, I go over to the little congregation in Fort Meade to teach. I hope most of you know, since it's been about 2 years since I've been here on a Wednesday night. And we just started a study in the book of Joshua recently, a few weeks ago, over there. One of the things that you run into when you read the book of Joshua is how many times it talks about piles of rocks. I think it's pretty unique in terms of books of the Bible in just how many times it talks about piles of rocks. And so we're going to look at some of those this morning. We're going to look at three, maybe four, depending on how fast the clock goes. And we're going to talk about what we can learn from the piles of rocks that the Israelites keep making in the book of Joshua. One of the reasons why the book of Joshua is kind of unique is that in it, pretty much the whole time the Israelites are doing the right things. There's one notable exception in chapter 7 that we'll talk about, but most of the time in the book of Joshua, the people of Israel are following God's instructions, they're doing things according to the right pattern, they're listening to Joshua, Joshua is leading them well, and everything is going well, for the most part. That's different from almost every other history book that we have in the Bible. It's also very different from the book that's going to come immediately after Joshua in Judges, and that's one of the things that we'll talk about at the end this morning. The first memorial that we're going to talk about that the children of Israel set up in the book of Joshua is found in chapter 4. Joshua begins with the transition of power from Moses to Joshua. Moses has just died, Joshua takes over, God comes to Joshua and he says, I'm giving you command, I'm going to be with you just as I was with Moses, don't be afraid, be strong and courageous, and I'm going to give you victory over the peoples of this land. And then the very first thing that happens after the spies go in, and in chapter 3, the Israelites come to the River Jordan. And God tells them that they're going to cross over it on dry ground. It's a fresh start for the people of Israel. They've just come out of 40 years wandering in the wilderness. The entire generation of the men of war who came out of the land of Egypt is dead. They died in the wilderness. The people who are now getting ready to enter the land are that generation's children. They were born in the wilderness wanderings for the most part. They haven't even been circumcised, we learn in the next chapter. And much like Moses began his leadership of the people by leading them across the Red Sea, Joshua begins his leadership of the people by taking them across the River Jordan. The River Jordan was not an impassable natural obstacle. I mean, people had boats by this point in history. They knew how to make rafts. The children of Israel had just spent 40 years walking for no purpose at all. They could have taken a little longer to walk to a place that was easier to cross. But God decided that he wanted to do it this way because he wanted to show the people of Israel, this new generation, that he was with them just as he had been with their parents. That just as Moses had had the authority and the power to lead them across the Red Sea, so Joshua had the authority and the power to lead them across the Jordan into the land of Canaan. God wanted them then to have a memorial. That's what we get to in chapter 4. After the people cross over on dry ground, the Ark of the Covenant, God's presence, goes into the middle of the river and the waters pile up in two heaps. And after the people cross over, Joshua is told to send 12 men back into the River Jordan to pick up stones from the dry riverbed in the very middle of the river and to make a pile of them. This is chapter 4 and verse 3. Carry them out and pile them up at the place where you will camp tonight. So one man from each tribe goes and gets a rock from the middle of the Jordan, where no person should ever be able to get a rock from because it should be deep in the riverbed, and they make a stack by their campground. And we learn what the purpose of this memorial was. In verse 7, verse 6, in the future your children will ask you, what do these stones mean? And then you can tell them, they remind us that the Jordan River stopped flowing when the Ark of the Lord's Covenant went across. These stones will stand as a memorial among the people of Israel forever. God told the Israelites that in the future, when their children came to them and asked why this random pile of rocks was here, he wanted them to remind them of God's providence. These stones mark the place where God brought us into the promised land. These stones mark the place where God made a clear path out of nothing. These stones mark the place where God's presence went before us and held the water back so that we could cross on dry land. That's how God provides for his people. That's how God cares for his people. In other words, God didn't just work this wondrous miracle so that the children of Israel wouldn't get wet. He did it so that they would know that day and remember every day afterward that God provides for his people, that God makes their paths straight, as we'll read later on in the book of Isaiah. The memorial at Gilgal by the River Jordan reminded the people of God's providence. The second memorial that we get to in the book comes just a couple chapters later, and it's quite different. It's also quite large, and we'll see why. It's in a place that's called the Valley of Achor. That name might ring a bell. In chapter 6 of Joshua, the people attack the city of Jericho. And they win somehow. God gives them a plan that makes absolutely no military sense whatsoever. If you try to lay siege to a city and just spend a week walking around it, nothing will happen. You won't even make an earthquake or anything that'll make the walls fall down. If the Battle of Jericho were filmed and put on TV, it would have one of those like car commercial disclaimers at the bottom that says, you know, professional driver, do not attempt, because it won't work. But because God is on their side, it does work. It shows his power. And God gives the Israelites one very specific instruction. He says, when you take the city of Jericho, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take the silver and the gold and put them into my treasury, and everything else in the city, whether it's human or material, is to be destroyed. The city is doomed to destruction, God says in chapter 6. And it goes almost perfectly. But there's always that one guy who doesn't follow instructions, and in this case, that one guy is named Achan. And so in chapter 7 of Joshua, we learn that the Israelites lose their next battle when they go up to attack the city of Ai. I mean, they've just checked Jericho off of their cities to take checklist, and they head right on to the next one, which is a small city. They think it's going to be easy to take, and they're completely defeated. 36 Israelites die. Joshua's in shock. He doesn't understand what's going on, and God comes to him, and he tells him that the reason the children of Israel have lost is because there's sin in the camp. Achan had taken... I did that when I talked about this at Fort Meade, too, and I was really planning to try not to use those two words together. Achan had been covetous and selfish and saw some things that he wanted from the city, some things that were forbidden, and taken them into his camp, and he'd buried them in the ground in his tent. And so God gives them instructions. They gather all the people together. They narrow the numbers down. They cast lots, and they narrow it by tribe and by clan and by family. And imagine being Achan. I mean, that had to take a long time. You're standing there in the middle of the congregation watching the numbers being narrowed down further and further toward you. And Achan and his entire family, all of his goods, his tent, everything that Achan had ever touched, essentially, is burned with fire and stoned with stones at the end of chapter 7. And the way the text reads, it almost sounds like the Israelites are instructed just to not stop throwing stones at them until the entire family was covered so you couldn't see them. It says at the end of chapter 7, in verse 24, Joshua and all the Israelites took Achan, the silver, the robe, the bar of gold, his sons, his daughters, his cattle, his donkeys, his sheep, goats, tent, and everything he had, and they brought them to the Valley of Achor. Then Joshua said to Achan, "Why have you brought trouble on us? The Lord will now bring trouble on you." And all the Israelites stoned Achan and his family and burned their bodies, and they piled a great heap of stones over Achan, which remains to this day. I told you this memorial was bigger. It was a pile of rocks large enough to cover everything that a man owned and his entire family. And this memorial is different because instead of reminding the people of God's providence, it reminded them of the penalty of sin and the destruction that sin can cause. Because if there's one thing that you have to come away realizing when you read Joshua chapter 7, it's that there is no sin that's so private that it doesn't cause destruction around it. I mean, think about what Achan did. By himself, he took a few relatively non-expensive items of loot from Jericho, and he brought them back to his tent, and he buried them in the ground. I mean, that's about as private as a sin can be. He didn't involve anyone else. It didn't affect anyone else, except that it did. Because that sin was enough for God to threaten in chapter 6 to take his presence away from the camp entirely. That sin resulted in 36 Israelite soldiers dying in battle, which was the greatest loss of life, I think, that would occur during the entire campaign, which, of course, is a miracle in itself. And it's ironic that Achan himself wasn't one of the 36 men who died in battle. His punishment came later. You read Joshua chapter 7 and you realize that sin is a disease. Sometimes I think it takes a story like this to help us see sin the way that God sees it. Because I'm still shocked every time I read the story. Because I come away thinking, was it really that serious? Was it really that bad? Did it really need that harsh of a punishment? I mean, did Achan's sin need to cause the entire congregation to lose, for men to die in battle? Did his sin really require the death of his entire family, of his children, of his wife? The punishment is harsh. It seems harsh, and it is harsh because it's harsher than I would ever be, because I don't look at sin the way that God looks at sin. And that's what the Israelites had to learn in Joshua chapter 7, that God sees sin as so deadly that it can endanger an entire congregation, that God sees sin as so deadly that it's worth eliminating at any cost, no matter if that's the loss of an eye or a hand, as Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5, or the loss of even God's own son. Any sacrifice is worth getting rid of sin. That's why Jude 7 describes sin in terms of snatching them out of the fire. He says, we should be on the watch for our brethren to fall into sin because they're heading into a fire and we need to snatch them out of it. When God talks to Joshua in chapter 7, there's a kind of hidden rebuke that Joshua should already know what's going on, that it was part of his responsibility as a leader of the people to be on the watch for the souls of the congregation. He should be aware of the problem. There's no such thing as a sin that only affects me. There's no sin that's so private or so personal that its poison doesn't infect those around me because it influences them to sin or because its consequences affect them. I mean, think of David and his sin with Bathsheba, which led not only to the death of Uriah, but to the death of David and Bathsheba's child, to the rebellion eventually led by Absalom, and David's family was messed up for years because of his sin. That's the terrible picture of sin which the Israelites would have seen every time they saw this enormous pile of stones. What do these stones mean? These stones are from a time when we sinned and people died for it. The third memorial, though, is again quite different. And it's in the very next chapter. In Joshua 8, right after all of this stuff with Achan gets finished up, Achan and his family are killed, and they're buried, and the Lord's anger turns away from the people, and he comes to Joshua in chapter 8 and says, don't be afraid. Don't be discouraged, for I've given the city of Ai, the king, his people, his town, and his land, I've given them all into your hand. I mean, right after this terrible defeat, right after this entire mess, God comes back and he says, okay, now everything's okay. The problem's been dealt with. I'm back. I'm on your side again, so don't be afraid. I'm with you. God says, don't let the mistakes of the past make you doubt your ability to serve me or to accomplish my will. I'm with you and you're going to be victorious. And they are. The people go out, they attack Ai again, they completely defeat the city. And interestingly enough, this time God says, you can have the spoils of the city. you can take the things that you want from it, which of course makes the sin of Achan that much harder, because you realize that if Achan had only waited on the providence and the generosity of the God that he served, he would have gotten what he wanted without sinning. This memorial reminded the people of the beauty of forgiveness. Because just after this defeat, just after the sin of the people, the sin of the congregation, God picked them back up and gave them victory over their enemies, even though they had just sinned and lost a battle because of it. And the author says about all of these piles of rocks, the author says that at the point of writing, these stones are still there to this day. They're still there. Anyone who walks by will see them, and they'll be reminded, in this case, of a time when the people purified themselves and removed the sin from their midst and returned to their service. Reminds me of Psalm 103. The familiar words there, beginning in verse 8. The Lord is compassionate and merciful, slow to get angry and filled with unfailing love. He will not constantly accuse us nor remain angry forever. He does not punish us for all our sins. He does not deal harshly with us as we deserve. For his unfailing love toward those who fear him is as great as the height of the heavens above the earth. He has removed our sins as far from us as the east is from the west. That's the God that we serve. That's the forgiveness that he offers. Even though he's a just God, even though he sees sin the way that we just saw in chapter 7 with that terrible picture of how serious it is, he's still a God who offers forgiveness and who, when he forgives us, forgets and picks us back up and gives piles of blessings. The fourth memorial is found in a cave near Makkedah in Joshua chapter 10. In Joshua chapter 10, the Israelites are in trouble because basically all of the kings in the surrounding area hear about the conquest so far and get nervous and decide to band together and make an alliance. And five kings bring their armies and come up against the people of Israel. And you would think, or you might think, if you didn't know much about God, that five kings against one Israelite army that really hasn't had a great deal of fighting experience would be pretty bad odds. But then you read chapter 10, and it is about as complete a defeat as it's ever possible to have. The Lord, first of all, throws the armies of the five kings into a panic, into a confusion, so they aren't even able to fight well. And the Israelites slaughter a lot of them. And then the Israelites are driving them back along the road, and the five kings' armies are retreating, and God decides to throw giant literal hailstones down from heaven on the fleeing armies. And that's pretty effective, it says in chapter 10. And then it's getting dark, and Joshua says, oh no, it's going to get dark before we manage to completely destroy all five of these armies that have come up against us. And so God says, okay, I'll just make the sun stand still so that you have more time. It's not because the Israelites were losing, it's because they were winning and weren't going to have time to win well enough. And so God makes the sun stand still. And the five armies that come up against them are completely destroyed. Then the five kings that led the five armies are running away, and they go and hide in a cave. And after Joshua finds them and kills them, he has their bodies placed back in the cave. And in chapter 10, in verse 27, it says that Joshua gave instructions for the bodies of the kings to be taken down from the poles and thrown into the cave where they'd been hiding, and they covered the opening of the cave with a pile of large rocks, which remains to this very day. This pile of rocks reminded the Israelites of something. And I think if the Israelites were thinking about this battle, they couldn't help but come away with the realization that it didn't matter what the odds were, that the God who was on their side was a God who could give them victory no matter what was up against them. This memorial would have reminded the people of God's victory. Reminded of Romans chapter 8, where, of course, the writer Paul says that there is nothing which can separate us from the love of Christ, not principalities nor powers. If God is for us, who can be against us? Psalm 124 says something similar. Psalm 124 says, "What if the Lord had not been on our side? What if the Lord had not been on our side when people attacked us? They would have swallowed us alive in their burning anger. The waters would have engulfed us. A torrent would have overwhelmed us." That has additional meaning when you think about the River Jordan crossing. "Yes, the raging waters of their fury would have overwhelmed our very lives. Praise the Lord, who did not let their teeth tear us apart. We escaped like a bird from a hunter's trap. The trap is broken and we are free. Our help is from the Lord, who made heaven and earth." That's the kind of thing that the Israelites would have thought about when they saw that pile of rocks at the mouth of the cave. If a son happened to ask his father, "Dad, why did they cover up the mouth of the cave like that with giant rocks?" Then the dad could say, "Because in that cave lies the enemies of Israel. In that cave are the remains of those who dared to attack God's people." Of course, God doesn't always work the same way nowadays that he worked back then. And thankfully, I hope that none of us ever find ourselves in the situation where we find five armies encamped against us, getting ready to attack, trying to kill us. But the point remains. It's why we read in Ephesians that God is able to do far more abundantly beyond anything that we can ask or think according to the power that is at work within us. Because the God we serve tells us that when he's on our side, there are no odds too great. There's no situation too overwhelming, no situation too chaotic that he will not be able to give us victory, that he will not be able to keep us safe, that he will not be able to keep us close to him. God always has a plan. Now, we talked about four memorials. I tried my best to find all of the memorials up to basically a certain point pretty early in Israel's history. There weren't that many, but there were several. And I marked them on this map. So there are eight on there, I believe. So those are eight piles of rocks that the Old Testament tells us about being put up around Israel. I mean, they're not everywhere, but there are quite a few of them. Those are all places that the Israelites, if they went by, would have been reminded of something about God. Reminded of something that had happened in their past. Reminded either of God's providence or of the devastation of sin and its effects or of God's forgiveness and protection, control over them. That's a different map. That's my map. I put 10 dots on there. I'm not going to tell you what they are, but I put 10 dots on there of places that I want to remind me of things like that. Of places where I don't obviously have a pile of stones. I don't have any kind of memorial there. Some of them I may never even go back to. But those are places where I remember things happening that I need to keep in mind. Things happening in my life. For instance, a time when I felt the providence of God. When Amanda and I were in Savannah, Georgia, that was a time when I felt the providence of God for a particular reason. There are a couple places on there where I felt the effects of my own sin. There are a couple places on there where I very clearly felt the control of God in my life. And although I don't have memorials there, much like the children of Israel were given places, events, where God acted in their lives very powerfully and expected them to remember those times, I think that not only should we remember times like this, but we should remember times in our own lives when that happens. Because eventually, hopefully, I'm going to have a son who's going to come to me like the son would have come to the father in Joshua chapter 4 and seen the pile of rocks and said, "Dad, what do these stones mean?" And if my son ever comes to me and says, "Dad, how do you keep your faith that things are going to work out? Because sometimes God just doesn't seem like he's there." I want to be able to say, not just, "Son, let's go to Joshua chapter 4, and I'll read you why God is always in control." But I want to be able to say, son, let me tell you about the time that your mother and I were in Savannah, Georgia. Because that's how I know that God is in control. That's how I remember God's providence. If I see my son heading down a dangerous path, I want to be able to say, son, let me tell you about a time when I sinned and I saw its effects in the lives of those around me. If my son ever feels overcome with guilt or inadequate, I want to be able to say, let me tell you about times that I came up short, but God forgave me and helped me to do wonderful things in his service. One of the things that comes up over and over in Israel's early history is God's instructions to tell their children about the things that had happened to them. Deuteronomy chapter 6, of course, at the beginning of that chapter, God talks about talking with their children when they are at home and when they are on the road and when they are going to bed and when they are getting up, tying them to their hands, wearing them on your forehead as reminders, writing them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. That's how clearly the people were supposed to communicate the laws of God to their children. And of course, in Joshua chapter 4, they're told to tell their children about the meaning of the memorials that are given. You know, memorials don't really do much if we aren't willing to communicate them to the next generation. God expects us to remember the triumphs and remember the mistakes of the past. And God also expects us to teach the next generation about those significances. I told you that the next book of the Bible was a lot different from Joshua. If Joshua is one of the best examples of faithfulness for Israel, Judges is the worst. There's almost nothing good in the book of Judges. Even most of the judges themselves are not particularly appealing characters. The people just repeatedly keep sinning and falling into judgment and calling out for God's help and being rescued and then doing it all over again. And the very first thing that you read in the book of Judges is that the last generation died and another generation grew up who did not acknowledge the Lord or remember the mighty things that he had done for Israel. So what was the problem? The reason for the faithlessness which arose in the day of the judges was that the new generation didn't remember the things from the past. The new generation didn't remember the sins of their parents. The new generation didn't remember the mighty deeds that God had done. Remembering the past is important. I went slightly out of order, so I'm going to go back to this slide so that you can actually see it. It's important to remember the times that God has shown his providence to us. It's important to remember the times that we have sinned and its effects. It's important to remember the times that God has shown us forgiveness and blessing and the time that he's shown his control. And above all, it's important to communicate those on to the next generation. The book of Joshua ends with one final memorial. There are a couple more thrown in there, but I didn't have time to talk about all of them. Because in Joshua chapter 24, as Joshua is getting ready to die, he shows exactly the kind of attitude that we're talking about. The desire to share with the next generation the knowledge of God that he has. And so we get the familiar words in Joshua chapter 24, beginning in verse 14, when Joshua says, "Fear the Lord and serve him wholeheartedly. Put away forever the idols that your ancestors worshipped when they lived beyond the Euphrates River and in Egypt. Serve the Lord alone. But if you refuse to serve the Lord, then choose today whom you will serve. Would you prefer the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates, or will it be the gods of the Amorites in whose land you now live? But as for me and my family, we will serve the Lord." The people respond by promising that they're going to serve God. And Joshua says, okay, I'm going to make a memorial of this. And near the end of the chapter, he sets up a memorial, a huge stone, and rolls it underneath a tree beside the tabernacle of the Lord, and says, this stone is going to be a witness. It's heard everything that you've promised, and it's going to be a witness against you to serve the Lord. you know, the choice that Joshua offers the people of Israel all that time back in the early days of Israel is the same choice that we're still faced with today. When he told them that they needed to choose whom they were going to serve. He started that whole discussion by saying that you came into this land and God gave you victory over them. He gave you land that you hadn't worked on. He gave you towns that you hadn't built, vineyards that you hadn't planted. He says, God provided for you. God gave you victory. So now you need to choose who you're going to serve. You need to remember the past and decide what's more worthwhile. Serving false gods, serving yourself, or serving the true God who provides, who forgives, and who wins. That's the choice we're still faced with today. Maybe you haven't made that choice. Maybe that's something that you haven't faced yet, but at some point you're going to come to the realization that you have to make a decision. You have to decide who you're going to serve. You have to decide whether to serve yourself, to follow your own desires, your own wishes, your own plan for your life, or whether to give your life up to one who has a better plan. So we're going to sing a song in just a minute, and I'd encourage you that if you don't have these kind of memorials set up, if you don't have these kind of memories of times when you could see God's involvement in your life, then the problem is not that God wasn't involved, but that you weren't allied with him. And I'd encourage you to start down a path that will allow you to, in the future, look back and see how well God has helped you, how greatly God has provided for you. Choose this day whom you will serve. As for me and my family, we will serve the Lord, Joshua says. If you need to respond to the call of the gospel, if you need to choose to dedicate your life to Christ, I encourage you to do so this morning without wasting any more time. And as we stand and sing, come forward.